Morning, Your Honors. My name is Donald McClellan. I'm an attorney representing Michael J. Alexander. Who is a lawyer. Mr. Alexander is a prominent criminal defense attorney, former prosecutor who brought a Federal Tort Claims Act against FBI agents, alleging malicious prosecution and intentional infliction of emotional distress arising from his arrest in 2008, a trial for conspiracy to commit bribery, his acquittal, the allegations.
What's the theory of why these FBI agents would conspire with the state prosecutor to try to nail your client?
The prosecutor who became in office in 2007 ran a rogue drug task force in the local area. Mr. Alexander was a frequent critic of the local drug task force.
What did the agents have to do with that? The agents weren't accused of impropriety by Alexander.
Not in that regard. I don't know why they joined in with the prosecutor other than this is something that they wanted to get, and they wanted to eliminate him as a critic.
Are you aware of other cases in which FBI agents have conspired with state prosecutors to frame people that the lawyers that are irritating the state prosecutor?
I've read other cases in other jurisdictions, not in this jurisdiction.
You're not answering my question.
Sorry.
Are there other cases in which FBI agents are plausibly accused of conspiring with state prosecutors to frame lawyers who are annoying the state prosecutor?
I'm unaware of any.
You know, the Supreme Court now requires, the result of the Twombly and Iqbal cases, that, you know, this sort of, we're supposed to apply a plausibility test to complaints. And even if we're not going to question the facts, but if the inference of illegality seems really implausible, we're supposed to dismiss.
Well, in this case,
isn't this strange? I mean, why would these FBI agents in Muncie be doing the dirty work of the state prosecutor and engaging? It's not just tortious act, but that would be criminal activity by the FBI agents.
All I can tell you is what the facts
are. Has there been investigation of the FBI agents? Did you or Alexander complain to the Justice Department that they have crooked FBI agents?
We actually tried the case and got him acquitted.
You're not answering my question.
No, we did not.
All right. Well, if I ask a question, you answer the question. Don't go off on something.
That's fine.
All right?
No, I did not. I don't know what we've made the complaint. We've talked with the U.S. attorneys. They know what the issue is, and they have determined that there's nothing here that they want to proceed with.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, we were able to develop, had the informants not rolled over on the FBI agent at trial. Both informants admitted at trial that they had had the prior meeting with Mr. Alexander in 06, that they told the FBI that Mr. Alexander provided the information. They didn't know anything that was going on, and he'd find out what was going on. They implanted the information at that time about the allegation of the bribery. And we get done with that. The FBI agent said that meeting never happened.
So I'm going to say your answer, if I'm understanding you, to Judge Posner's important question about plausibility is that even if you don't quite know what was inside somebody's mind, you do have evidence that however unfortunate and unlikely it is, the FBI agents, in fact, you've got testimony showing that the FBI agents were misbehaving. And I think your second answer is when you spoke to the U.S. attorney, that was what you were doing to notify the Department of Justice, even if you didn't go to Maine Justice.
That's correct. In fact, I think, and I apologize, and you kind of hit me on the side on it, I think we sent a letter to the agency that handles a special agency the U.S. attorney has to investigate?
With the public integrity section?
I believe we did. As now that you mentioned, it's been a while, but I do believe we sent and never got a response to that. Mm-hmm. And it was, but I do, I apologize, but I do believe we did do that.
So where you seem to be going is, even though, you know, we of course hope that FBI agents never do things like this, if you have the informant at the actual trial showing at least one side of the story and the FBI agent saying, no, it never happened, and the informant saying, yes, it did happen, that is enough to show something that could have happened, even though, you know, that's not yet proving something by a preponderance of the evidence or whatever, but it's not physically impossible. It could have happened.
We in actuality had both informants who said they were digital recorded, sent in, and had a 10-minute meeting with Mr. Alexander after being there for an hour waiting for him. He at that time said he didn't have any idea what they were this is when they told him about the bribery involving his former client, Mr. Bryant. So I don't know what you're talking about.
This dirty investigator who's behind all of this?
Apparently, yes, okay. Mr. Hines.
Because he winds up getting convicted.
He
right?
does. Yeah. And he says, well, I'll find out. I'll talk to Hines. I'll find out what's going on. Now get out of my office. These informants then go out and tell the FBI that's what took place. We asked for the digital recordings of that meeting, because this is what Mr. Alexander told me what happened. One of the recordings never is found. The other one ends at 40 minutes. It never, and the conversation's never there. The FBI.
So that's exculpatory information, right?
Your
guy's denying that he knows anything about the bribery, and the agents concealed the exculpatory information?
There's also, that was the evidence that was in plan, but it also led also to exculpatory and the implanting of the knowledge later. Because if you get into February of 07, they send the informants in the third time, and these are the time now the recordings work, and Alexander now has knowledge of the bribery involving his investigator and his former client. Now, how did he get that? He got it from the informants 7 months earlier when they were sent in by the FBI. But of course, if that meeting never takes place, And there's no exit interview, and there's no recordings of that meeting, and the informants don't roll over, then what you're left with is Alexander knows about something, and the only way he would know is if he was involved. But see, he knew because they had provided him the knowledge back in July. So it not only is exculpatory, it also is the basis that he had any knowledge of it.
So your complaint, you're saying, has enough factual information that this path to the malicious prosecution, cooperated in by the FBI agents, obviously they're not the immediate prosecutors, but they're working with them, and also your intentional infliction of emotional distress happens through this set of, you kind of set up the conflict, the lie, if you will.
Yes.
Were you given a chance to replead on this when the case gets dismissed?
In fact, what happened was I had burned that. I had regularly filed a complaint. They filed a motion to dismiss. I filed an amended complaint prior to the court making a ruling. That was my error. I was a
okay.
little...
Okay, but not after... Oftentimes, in especially the post-Twombly-Iqbal era, when a district court dismisses under 12b-6, citing Twombly and Iqbal, the court will dismiss with an opportunity to replead once. You know,
yeah, I don't think that was not...
That did not happen. Okay.
That was not the issue.
You may want to save your last minute.
Okay,
thank you.
Mr. McClellan. Ms. Woods.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Shalise Woods, and I represent the United States. To this day, including today here in the courtroom, the appellant has never articulated a clear and sufficient theory of malicious prosecution or IIED against the United States.
I don't know why you say that, because actually he has shown I mean, he hasn't articulated motive, but Rule 8 doesn't require a detailed exposition of motive in complaints. Complaints are supposed to be for purposes of stating a plausible claim of what happened, and I would like to think that a lot of government corruption is something that we believe is very rare and that shouldn't happen. And I'm troubled with two arguments that the government has made here. One pertaining to the malicious prosecution, where you seem to think because the United States wasn't the prosecutor, it's impossible. But that's, of course, inconsistent with our Reynolds decision and fails to recognize the role that the investigative officers play in state court prosecutions. And secondly, you don't seem to recognize on the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim the fact that acts were taken right up through the trial. This wasn't a single act, we fired you on Tuesday, March 3rd kind of event. This was a continuing source of actions taken by officers of the United States. So both of those give me great concern about the position of the United States.
Yes, Your Honor. On the first concern, and I want to be clear, the United States is not arguing that it's impossible for these agents to have instituted the action.
All right. So it's not impossible. What do you do with Reynolds?
With Reynolds, Your Honor, I think that Reynolds actually contrasts nicely with our argument in this case. In Reynolds, if you look at Ms. Reynolds' allegations, she had a clear and sufficient allegation of malicious prosecution by the wrongdoer.
But what do you mean by that? I mean, she is saying, I was prosecuted because these FBI agents framed me, basically. I understand that. I mean, whether it happened or not is, you know, I'm not in a position to say, but it's certainly understandable.
Your Honor, there is a malice prong under Indiana law in both the malicious prosecution context and in the IIED context. And the Indiana Supreme Court and the courts of appeal have stated that it's not enough to simply allege some sort of sloppiness or wrongdoing.
But pleading in federal court uses federal court rules. It does not use Indiana rules.
That's correct.
And but Rule 9B, I'm going to read to you the last sentence, malice, intent, knowledge, and other conditions of a person's mind may be alleged generally. So if Indiana wants it specific in Indiana's courts, it's entirely free to do that. But Rule 9B says it may be general in federal court.
Your Honor, in this case, we have no allegation of malice.
I don't understand this malice business. Suppose that the FBI agents were personal friends of this state prosecutor. Nothing to do with business. And the state prosecutor says to them, look, you're my friends, and this guy is driving me crazy, this lawyer, Alex, he's driving me crazy. So would you mind helping me to nail him? And they say, fine, you're our friends, we'll do this. Now, that surely is malicious prosecution, even though in this example, the agents have no malicious hostility to Alexander. They're indifferent to Alexander. They're doing something for a pal. It's still malicious prosecution, isn't it?
There's no allegation of that, Your Honor.
Answer my question. My hypothetical, is that malicious prosecution?
That could be, Your Honor.
What do you mean could be? What do you mean could be? It is malicious
prosecution. It would state a claim. And much like in the Reynolds case, Ms. Reynolds.
I don't see that it seems to me it's not the question whether how the FBI agents felt about Alexander. The question is, let me ask you, did anything come out in the criminal trial of Alexander suggesting some kind of motive of some sort for these FBI agents?
Not that I am aware of to this day. That has never been.
There was testimony that they lied.
It was testimony that the informant said a conversation took place and the agent said, I don't recall that conversation taking place.
But why do you think that you can't infer a state of mind from somebody's actions? That's what most of us do anyway, since we can't read other people's minds. It's almost always an inference from actions. So at the 12B6 level, you know, we're not talking about summary judgment here or reviewing a verdict. I'm baffled to think that there aren't enough facts here from which an inference of malice could be drawn.
Your Honor, I would suggest in this case that Mr. Alexander had two depositions of Special Agent Freeman in his criminal case. He had the opportunity to cross-examine Special Agent Freeman in his criminal case. There have been four iterations of a complaint regarding Special Agent Freeman and Special Agent Howell. Still, to this day, there is no theory at all as to why these FBI agents would have engaged in wrongdoing. This is not a case.
Listen to yourself. I mean, my goodness, this is 12B6. You're talking about all these depositions and stuff. You're not supposed to have to prove your case.
That is
true. And you don't have to plead elements, and you don't have to plead motive more than generally. You're accusing them of doing things that would be very good arguments to make if we were reviewing a summary judgment. But we're not.
And, Your Honor, were it not for Iqbal and Cooney and other cases that say conspiracy allegations like this, they require something more. This is federal law, Your Honor. They require more than just broad and conclusory statements.
But we're getting the who, when, what, where, how. We may not have the why, but we're getting a lot of details in this complaint.
Not exactly, Your Honor. What is this false evidence? What is it? In Ms. Reynolds' case, she said, this agent was out to get me because I wouldn't go out with him, and he was mad, and he had it out for me. That was alleged in the complaint. She also said, I said X to the agent, and in the probable cause affidavit, he put Y. I didn't say why. And that was the crux of her being charged with a crime.
Well, it alleges that the agent included in the probable cause affidavit false evidence that he and Kurtz created on February 1, 2007. And it alleges, you can infer from the allegations, that without that information, there would not have been probable cause.
What is the false evidence, Your Honor?
Why is that necessary? I have to say, you know, we are heading straight back to the 19th century in pleading, and it doesn't seem to me a helpful development. He's alleged the false evidence, as Judge Tinder just said. And for stating a claim, you know, you want, you know, a psychiatric expert. And I just don't see where anything in Twombly, anything in Iqbal calls for that. They want a plausible case. What happened? There's no doubt that this man got indicted. There's no doubt that he went on trial. The prosecution happened. I mean, that's not the figment of anybody's imagination. And it was done for inappropriate reasons.
And for that reason, rather than just rest on the argument that this complaint is broad and conclusory, we, and I would suggest the district court judge very generously read the facts in the notice of the tort claim, in the briefs, and in the complaint. Facts that, quite frankly, were not in the complaint.
What would be the minimum that would have to be added?
Your Honor,
that could be done without discovery, by the way.
Yes. Your Honor, some allegation of intent, motive, it only has to be an allegation, a general allegation.
The intent is maliciousness. That's all that's required. And motive is not part of the case. And motive can be part of the case, but it's not required. It's not an element.
It is an element, Your Honor.
It makes it more plausible if there's a motive.
That's the point, yeah.
Under IIED.
What you're saying is, let me reference that Reynolds case. You want to have a motive in order to overcome the improbability that for no reason at all a pair of FBI agents would commit criminal activity on behalf of some lawyer, on behalf of some state prosecutor, right? That's what you want, something to overcome that implausibility.
We want a motive, Your Honor. Yes, that's true.
Judge Tinder is right. Motive is not is not an element of malicious prosecution.
Acted maliciously is an element.
Now, forget all that. That word malicious should be purged from the legal lexicon. It doesn't do any work. It doesn't. Its meaning is totally unclear. No, if someone was willing to testify, these FBI agents were, I don't know, romantically involved with a state prosecutor, something like that, right, then you'd be satisfied, huh? So you want a motive to show plausibility, really. That's
Your Honor, what I want is what the case law says there needs to be.
The case law.
More than a statement simply of the word malice. It's not enough.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Wood. So, Mr. McClellan, something further? See, what I find troublesome about your case, are you saying that any time that witnesses testify differently in a case, you have a witness for the prosecution says one thing, witness for the defense says the opposite, and then the person is acquitted, that is enough for a prima facie case of malicious prosecution?
Absolutely not.
Okay, so what more is required? What more is there in this case, right?
Well, there was the probable cause was created, it was manufactured to charge Mr. Alexander. And that's the malice. The malice is inferred by
where's the manufacture?
Well, we have two issues. We have the 06 July meeting where the evidence is destroyed and the exit interview is destroyed. And then we have
when you say destroyed, they're not recorded. We don't know why they weren't recorded.
One of them disappears, and the other one ends at 40 minutes. And then we have the February 1st meeting with Kurtz after he's charged with a dope dealing charge, and he goes in. Now he's got two recordings on him, and both of them turn up blank with nothing on them.
Okay, so you have the blank recordings. That's the first thing. And do you have anything else?
Well, we then have the informants coming in later and saying, we met with the FBI, we told him what took place.
No, but that's one person's word against another's, right?
Now,
my question is whether just having a disagreement at a trial is enough to allow for a malicious prosecution case. So you have the recordings. Do you have anything else besides the disagreement at the trial?
Well, you have the testimony by the FBI agent that the meetings took place, the meetings didn't take place, and that there was a mistake with these recordings, and the people coming in and saying the meetings did take place, and we told the FBI what had taken place in the meetings.
So the FBI said that, did they say they didn't? The meetings didn't take place? They don't remember the meetings or what?
They didn't take place. I took two depositions of the Freeman. He said the meeting did not take place.
And the people who said they did take place were who?
The two informants.
Okay, so it's the informants versus the FBI, right?
Correct.
Can you see my concern that you don't want a situation which, especially because the government has a heavy burden of proof of conviction. The fact that someone is acquitted is not proof that his witnesses were telling the truth and the prosecutor's witnesses were lying.
No.
Right?
You're correct.
So you're really just left with the recordings.
Well, the other issue that occurred was there was another informant who contacted us during the trial and said this was all made up. This is an all made up story. We recorded him. By the two informants. At trial, he changed his story that he'd been threatened, and he and the FBI agent had met and talked about this, even though it wasn't.
But he'd been threatened by your client.
Well, by somebody at a bar threatened him, and so he.
Not the FBI.
No. And then he told the FBI agent, even though it wasn't part of this story, I mean, part of their protocol, never made a recording, I mean, made any notation of that conversation. Then later, after the case is all over, the individual told us that he, the FBI agent came to him and told him to come up with a story. And that's in the allegations. So,
okay. Well, thank you, Mr. McClellan.
Very much.
Woods.